Hello and welcome to Say That, the podcast for your big questions, your real answers. My name is Matt King. I'm your host here in the city of Chicago. Joining us here is Jed Brewer.
Indeed.
With us all the way from Rutgers, Tennessee is Lee Younger.
Yes, and I want to say that when I woke up, it was like 24 degrees today, and I was like, what's going on? I don't live in Chicago. This is not fair.
It was like 55 degrees here for most of the day.
And it's pretty great, man.
That's a fun mental exercise because you think like, oh,
yeah,
it's 60 degrees and it's February. And then you think about everything you know about the world and you go, oh, it's 60 degrees and it's February.
Right.
So it's a real, you know, the glass is half empty. The glass will be on fire in 10 years situation.
Yeah, it's going great.
It is going great. I tell what else is going great, gentlemen, and that is the Christian entertainment industry.
It is, because I'm legitimately surprised to hear that. But well, wow, I mean, if you say so.
I mean, as in all things, the question of going great would be going great for who. And if you have a podcast that really needs grist for the mill of making fun of the Christian entertainment industry, it's going great. The project before us today is a an animated Bible project called something called the iBible, which basically is we want kids to read the Bible, but we don't think kids can read at this point, so we're just trying to make animated shorts about the Bible.
Okay.
Which, you know, sure. Also trying to raise $25 million, which is, you can make a lot of drawings for $25 million. But, we've covered such things before, and you ask, what sets it apart? And there is one here. There's one very interesting thing I want to hone in on, which is you may notice, dear listener, if you've ever spent much time reading or hearing about or even taking a cursory glance at the Old Testament, it gets kind of buck wild in places.
Yeah. Mm.
So if you were to be creating a child-focused product, you may think, well, this is a little sensitive. How do we handle such things? And their plan apparently is just go ahead and put it in there and let parents figure it out later.
Cool.
Quote, for a long time, the iBible team was torn on how to tell stories of violence and abuse appropriately for kids. Their first feedback from parents on the episode depicting the sexual assault of Dina, the daughter of Lee and Jacob, convinced the project team that showing these parts of scriptures was essential. It also forces churches to have tough but essential discussions with kids. I can't think of if you want $25 million, I can't think of a less effective sales pitch than, hey, churches who we need to buy this. This will make you have to have some really uncomfortable conversations.
That's right.
You know, the 24-year-old person who just kind of wanted to help and there was nothing else really for them to do than teach a Sunday school class. Well, now they get to deal with this. Now, obviously, that's a very dark version of that, but there is some stuff in the Old Testament that I think would be a very interesting to do a grim and gritty kind of DC studio animation version of.
Sure, yes, the David Ayer version.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and of course, everybody's favorite part of entertainment for youth and where the real money is, maybe we can come in on this, is the merchandising.
Yeah,
so I'm picturing the very kind of prestige $40 a pop action figure sets
from the Todd McFarlane Studios.
Yep, that we say are for the children because this thing is technically for children, but we know it's all going to be bought by guys in their 30s.
Yep, 100%.
But you know, it's really hardcore. It's the prophet Elisha, bears sold separately,
murdered teenagers in a different set.
That's right. The one I was, and this is getting out of the Old Testament, but having a Jezebel figure, but it comes with the head of John the Baptist.
Oh, very nice.
Like, I don't know if you guys remember, like, if you get your G.I. Joes or whatever, they were in the blister packs, and it'd be like the guy, and then next to him would be like, it's his helmet or his gun or whatever, but one of those is just the head of John the Baptist. A Samson that you can really cut the hair off of.
Yes, well, the one for me is, if they're really not going to shy away from anything, then, you know, when this series starts making its way through the book of Judges, Is there going to be like a concubine that gets that like is you're able to divide into 12 pieces?
Oh, wow. Wow.
And, and you know, I'm picturing like a 7-year-old kid getting a new action figure for Christmas. Oh, look, it's the concubine from Judges that you can actually cut into 12 pieces and reassemble when you're done playing.
Sure, it like has like magnetic sections that snap back together.
That's right.
That's you the Lego tie-in right there.
And when you get the full set, then you actually have representatives of all the 12 tribes of Israel that you can send the different pieces to.
Sure. I think that's very good. I think as a Deborah figure with real spike driving action.
Yes.
Kind of do a kung fu grip kind of thing.
There's an Ark of the Covenant that if carried the wrong way, it will just explode the other toys around it.
Yes. Exactly. Yes. Right.
Well, and there's your Indiana Jones tie-in.
Yes. My biggest question for this animation studio and this mindset behind this is, okay, you've said that. Are you really going to make a short film of the Song of Songs? Because...
Yeah.
Even before you get to the Song of Songs, I think that's a great question. For me, the first real, like, if I was setting out to do this and just kind of flipping through Genesis, the first real whoopsie doodle moment would be, okay, got the story of Noah. God floods the earth. That's not, you know, that's going to be a little tough, you know, but, you know, it's a conversation you need to have if you're going to be a person of faith. Oh, good. The flood's over. Wine and daughters and oh no.
Yeah, this is so my thing when I was a kid and I would get you know the figurines of you know different toys of cartoons that I liked or characters or action heroes or whatever, it was always cool to have like more than one version, you know, of that character.
Heck yeah, so, alternate Spider-Man suit.
Exactly. So, you know, you have like the arc building Noah, and then you have like the drunk naked Noah that Ham walks in on the tent and finds and then does whatever with. And that is just a little awkward to say like, Mom, I already have arc building Noah. I need drunk naked Noah now.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
Got to complete the set, man. And Graham always buys you the wrong ones. Now you've got 3 naked tent Noahs, and you still don't have an arc building one. Just the play sets never quite match up.
So is there going to be a figurine of like Absalom with a tree, and he's hanging from the tree by his hair with the spear of Joab in his abdomen?
Possibly. I mean, the spear of Joab sold separately, definitely.
Absolutely. That's just a monetization strategy right there.
Well, as ever, just to make sure we weren't, you know, going too far with the reservation here, I looked to see what some kind of Christian, some Old Testament figurines people might be buying. And there's a few. There's a Leviathan, which I thought was a bold move.
Okay.
Which is pretty lazy, if I'm being honest. This is clearly like some factory in China had some leftover like Disney, the dragon or the dragon from Shrek or something, and just kind of, or the dragon from Mulan, and just kind of,
yeah,
hack something on it. But I did find on no less a source than christianbook.com, Goliath in the Spirit Warrior series category here.
Okay.
And this is the only one I found that has some reviews.
Okay.
The Goliath figure, overall, currently rating at a 2.7 out of 5.
Yeah.
2.2 for quality, 2.5 for value, and 1.7 for meets expectations. The first review is exactly what you'd expect. It's from a woman named Carol, who gives it a 5 out of 5 and says, "My grandsons loved this action figure." Did he, Carol? He's realistically fierce and a good platform for learning the Bible story. I'm not sure if she's describing the figure or the grandson is realistically fierce. But either way, I celebrate it. And then this is what I would like. The boys like action figures, and I'm happy to give them something wholesome.
Oh,
are you familiar with the story of David and Goliath?
Yeah,
apparently not.
Because it's about a child murdering someone with a projectile. Now, whether or not he had it coming, we can is a topic for a different day. But wholesome is a very interesting descriptor.
Yeah,
of this child soldier putting a projectile through someone's skull and then cutting his head off, a thing that happens.
Yeah,
that's right.
But then,
so I'm sorry, carry on. I was just gonna say, after, like, we're talking about the variations of these different characters, and you know, there's a really bizarre story where David, after some of these military exploits as a young man, is invited by the king of Israel to potentially court his daughter, and in hopes of maybe marrying the king of Israel's daughter. And the king says, "You can marry my daughter if you bring to me 100 Philistine foreskins." So is that like a version of the would-be King David action figure is like, it's 100 Philistine foreskins David?
Or is that the thing, like, with the old school box tops or whatever, like the Willy Wonka style thing? Collect all 100.
That's it.
The thing on the Goliath figures that really gets me, and because, you know, it had a pretty low rating, a pattern emerges in the negative reviews, which are summed up by this one from Pamela. "I was hoping Goliath would be larger than this action figure is, at least larger than the David figure."
Wow.
"Everyone knows the story of David and Goliath, the giant Philistine, but these characters are all the same size. I would recommend making David the size of a boy that he really was," says Tony. Now, we'll point out, you're buying this for $7.99 and free shipping on christianbook.com. I think you can only expect so much articulation and craftsmanship given that.
Totally fair. Have you gotten yet to the official product description? Because it's pretty delightful.
No, please regale us.
"Children will love collecting these Bible warrior action figures. Goliath is on the team of Philistines versus Israel, and he represents giant strength. Action figure comes complete with his giant spear. Read more about David in 1 Samuel 17. Recommended for ages 3 and up."
Nowhere else. Read 1 Samuel 17 and then stop.
I there are so many things that are delightful to me here. The first is the idea of casting this as team sports.
Yeah.
Yes.
Goliath is on the team of the Philistines versus Israel. What was it, an away game? Is that what happened? Like, which jerseys were they wearing? Also, I really appreciate that we've decided, well, look, we can't have a free-for-all. Like, you wouldn't want a two-year-old hearing a story about decapitation. As soon as Timmy turns three, though, he's fine. He's ready for the raw, unvarnished truth of decapitating our enemies.
Yeah, the team thing really does fire the imagination. You're picturing some kind of scoring system. If you describe, the siege that they were a part of is really the Israelite army coming from behind on that one.
This action figure is also very white. Like, this is just a white dude with a brown beard.
Yeah, I mean, that's a given. This is, again, for all the world, this looks like some kind of dwarf or generic, like, troll action figure that they were like, we got a lot of these left over. Give it a spear.
Yeah, yeah.
Reskinned, as they say.
Indeed. I just appreciate he represents giant strength. That's not what the word represents means, man.
Yeah, also, I know at Sunday school, you don't have to, like, not everybody in the story has to bring a positive message to the steel. He's a big dude who got hit in the head with a rock. That was pretty much his narrative structure there.
Yeah, you know, the thing I've been thinking about is, so, you know, obviously, like, I grew up in churchy stuff, and you know, there are all these, like, really bouncy, happy-sounding, you know, children's songs, you know, Father Abraham, you know. But I was thinking about, you know, Joshua and the Battle of Jericho, right? Which apparently Elvis Presley sang at one point, which is surprising. But, you know, it's
Tupelo,
the—
Tupelo, Mississippi.
well, you know, Joshua fought the battle of Jericho, Jericho, you know, and like, and then it lands on, and the walls came tumbling down. But I love that in this
on
new
civilians,
that's the thing. I love in our new raw, gritty cinematic Bible universe for kids that we want to talk about the completely mandated and widespread genocide of every living thing in Jericho. So, but it's the same dancy melody, like, you know, because it says in the Bible clear they killed all the livestock too. So you got to have a verse like, you know, Joshua killed all of the goats, the goats, the goats. And you could just go through every animal that they had, right? Because the walls came tumbling down. Like, I think, like, you could have so many verses in a Bob Dylan way. This could be like a 15-minute song, wow. Man.
So you're saying as part of the, you know, the iBible Battle of Jericho kind of teaching, ancillary teaching materials that would come with it, there's a whole unit on why it's critical to totally decimate your enemy's food supply?
That's right. That's right. Yes, yes. Well, I love the idea of kind of getting into a philosophical thing of like, you know, Joshua engaged in total war, total war, total war. Like, you can teach your kids about military philosophy at the same time they learn about the Bible.
Nice.
Sure. It's an important footnote is that the Battle of Jericho took place some 4,000 years before the foundation of the Geneva Convention, making these technically not war crimes. Again, much like where we started with the iBible here, I think this may create more questions than it answers for the youth. But here's some good news from the original article. The episodes, which are planned to depict the Hebrew Bible and New Testament, were also reviewed by Anglican, Presbyterian, Baptist, Pentecostal, and Methodist clergy members.
Okay.
Did you say it was good news?
Well, it, again, it was news in the sense of content, because that's got a real three guys walk into a bar joke vibe about it. And yeah. Also, I think one of the DVD extras should be just the live feed of that meeting.
Yes. Yes.
12 Angry Men style, everybody agreeing, and the Pentecostal just absolutely going off the reservation.
Yeah. I'm also envisioning with all this, like, a leader's guide of, like, you know, you're taking your, I'm assuming, you know, class full, your Sunday school class full of 6-year-olds to this material.
Sure.
And, you know, you're talking about, you know, killing all the goats, and there's a bouncy tune that goes with it. And in the leader's guide, like, you know, in case a hard question comes up, you know, like, one of the kids, like, you know, but why did they have to kill all the goats? And you turn in the leader's guide, and it's like, if this question arises, go, well, what's your favorite cartoon? I think that's what's in the leader's guide. And that yeah. also is a certain form of delightful.
Sure. Helen, thank you so much for volunteering to lead Children's Church. You know, I know you're a retired educator. We appreciate that. So here's the DVD to put in the player. Here's your leader's guide. And here's half a dozen smoke bombs. In case they ask one of these three questions. Step one, yell smoke bomb. Step two, deploy. Step three, run for the nearest exit. And that is how we lost more Sunday school teachers than we like to admit. We went from a 1-month, ever since we instituted the iBible curriculum, we had to go from a 2-month to a 2-week rotation for our Sunday school teachers.
Yep.
They kept slamming headfirst into the door in a cloud of smoke. And on that, we will declare emergency off. We'll move ahead to your fine questions. If you have a question for us, hang out with us all the way to the end. I'll give you some ways to get in touch with us, or you can scroll down to your episode description. Click the links you find there. Our first question comes in and says, I've struggled with anxiety and depression. I'm generally doing better, but sometimes I feel those old habits starting to creep up. How do I respond when that happens? I think it is an excellent question. And Lee, where did we kick off?
Yeah, this is a great question. So glad that you wrote it in. And the place that I would encourage you to start is, if you have never pursued this before, would be professional medical help and therapy. And let me be really clear about something. I don't know what your current church context is, but there are certain churches, especially big ones with a, you know, a fleet of staff, that will say that they offer, quote unquote, and I'm going to do this, the scare quotes, counseling services. If you go to a church that offers, quote, counseling services, I would just be cautious with that pursuit, because when I say that you should seek professional medical help or therapy, what I'm saying there is you want to find a person who has letters after their name, certain letters, because they are licensed to do that. Letters like LPC, a licensed professional counselor, actual mental health professionals, family or, you know, family counseling service professional, people with letters after their name.
Yes. Counseling services, much like if you pull a product off the shelf that describes itself as cheese product, you should wonder why they need an extra word on that.
Yeah.
That's right. Wow, this is cheese that somehow just sits on a shelf unrefrigerated. How does that work?
Smoke bomb!
Exactly. So, yes, I would encourage you to do that and to make sure that's a person that's qualified to offer the kind of help that you're looking for. After that, the thing that I would encourage you to do is to look at the difference between what you think or folks around you think is supposed to make you feel good versus the things that actually do make you feel good. Like, do you know what equals a good day for you? A positive day for you where you felt good and things went well. By the way, zero judgment if you don't know how to answer that question. Absolutely zero judgment whatsoever. I think there's plenty of folks who don't investigate, what do I actually like? What actually equals a positive day for me? We live in a society and a culture that tries to answer those questions for people all of the time without, you know, individuals in the society and culture actually taking any time to get to know themselves at a certain deep level. So I would encourage you to seek out the answers to some of those questions. Investigate, look into what makes you feel energized, what makes you feel at peace, what makes you feel like, you know what, I've got a lot of room in my headspace, in my kind of bandwidth for hanging out with people, for conversation, that kind of stuff. And let's see if we can't, once you start figuring out what some of those are, intentionally scheduling and making those things a part of your day. I think that would be a couple of great places to start. Again, thanks for writing in. It's a fantastic question. Start there and let's see if we can't get a good hold on lining up some good days one by one.
Absolutely. I think that's a wonderful place to start that off. And Jed, where do we go from there?
Now, that's great stuff, and I very much want to pick right up on what Lee is saying. Appreciate you writing in. Man, I'm really glad that you're doing better. That's awesome. That's fantastic. And my follow-up question for you is, do you know what the things are that helped you to be in a place of feeling and doing better? Like, I'm guessing that doing better that you've been experiencing probably didn't happen by accident. There's probably some steps that you took, some things that you did, maybe some things that you got rid of that helped you to be in a better place. Do we know what those things are? And it's okay if we don't, but that would definitely be something. If you're in a place in your life, which is actually really cool, where you're like, okay, there's a season where I was having a hard time. There's a season where I've been doing notably better. But I can kind of see some echoes of the unfun season trying to work their way back in. Do we know what got us from A to B? And if we don't, can we take some time to reflect on that? Try and look at what those things are. One of the reasons why it can be good to talk to a physician, to talk to a licensed counselor, is to identify those things. It's always great to be in a position where we can build off of a success we're already having. And so that's one thing that we definitely want to do here is, let's understand the success that we've already experienced here. Let's capitalize that. Let's build on that. As we do that, then one of the questions we'll need to ask is, once we've identified the things that helped get us from the harder season into the better season, are those things still working? If we're still doing them, are they still working? Are they still yielding good results? Like, if they were helping and then we stopped doing them, It's possible that that's part of why we can see the echoes of the not fun season trying to make a resurgence. Not a guarantee, but it's certainly possible. It's also possible that, no, we're doing the stuff that helped before, but maybe it's not working as well, or it's not working in the same way as it used to. In which case, do we need to modify our approaches some? That's totally okay. One of the things that it's important for anybody to remember is that most of us need different things in different seasons. There are some therapeutic elements, and when I say that, I mean everything from medication to counseling to meditation to breathing exercises to mood journaling, you know, any kind of self-care. There's stuff that works super well in one season and just isn't as effective for all kinds of reasons in another season, and that's okay. The idea that, you know, we're going to lock in, these are the three things that I do, and they're always, you know, what I need them to be. I hope that that happens, but for plenty of people, things vary over time. And so that then gets to the question of, do we have advisors in our lives, including a physician, including a licensed therapist, who can help us to dial in what is working today, what has worked in the past, what might work in the future? I think one thing to be really encouraged by, and one thing to feel really, really hopeful about, is you have already made, based on the question and the way you worded it, you've already made progress on this. And if you've made progress before, you can make more progress in the future. If you've seen some improvement before, I think it's very, very likely that you can see some improvement in the future. And part of why it's so important to have a clear sense of that is one of the things that anxiety wants to do and depression wants to do is to tell us, man, you're always going to feel just like this.
Yeah.
It's never going to get any better. It's always going to be just like this. There's no point in even trying. And if you've not had a season in your life of improvement, then that message can be very sticky because, I mean, maybe, but for you, because you have had that season of seeing some improvement and seeing some change and some growth, you are aware that at the very least, that message from depression and anxiety doesn't have to be true. It was not true in the past, and it doesn't have to be true in the future, which means that there's every reason for hope. When we join hope with positive action, the sky's the limit. And I think the one last thing that I would say is, and this I am preaching to myself because I can fall victim to this as well. When you're doing well, but you can see some symptoms of stuff that you don't want to kind of fully flare up on you, you don't have to wait till it's a crisis to make some changes. You don't have to wait till it's absolutely kick you in the butt to take action. If you're like, no, that's starting to, I can see that and I don't want that to be, let's get out ahead of it. Let's take some steps. Let's talk to some people. Let's figure out what we need to dial in. It's generally easier to fix things early rather than later. You're already pointed in that right direction. So take courage, take confidence, take those next steps and get not only to a better place, but to a much better place where you feel hopeful and confident and good about yourself and about your future.
Yeah, absolutely. Great stuff from both these guys. One thing I would add on the end here is just because a single behavior or issue has popped up does not mean you are kind of on the slippery slope back to where you were. And if anything, yep. Catching something can be a victory and making a different choice. You know, if you find out that, you know, when you're having a hard time, you might be home on a day off or working from home, whatever, and you wouldn't turn the lights on until noon. You just kind of sat in the dark because that's what felt right. If you notice, says, hey, it's 10 a.m. I haven't really turned the lights on yet. That can't be great. Sometimes that could be, you know, mean you really are on the edge of some deeper. Sometimes it could just mean, let's go ahead and turn the lights on. Let's train our yep. brain in that way and use these environmental factors as a way to improve the situation as opposed to indicators that the situation is bad. And there's victories to be had in that all around. All right, with that, we're going to move on to our next question here. It comes in and says, my non-Christian or ex-Christian friends have a big problem with the idea of sin in the sense that the idea that there's something fundamentally evil about them has been used to make them feel bad. I kind of see their point, honestly. Is there a way to think of sin without all the guilt and judgment? And an excellent question. I think very, 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 very well stated. And Lee, where do we start off here?
It is a really cool question. And by the way, it's very cool for you to be thinking outside of the box on how to relate to your friends who are either not believers or have walked away from, you know, kind of walked away from whatever they understood about their faith and stuff like that. Very, very cool and understanding of you. So let's do this. Let's completely change the channel off of the religious stuff for a second. And let's just talk about this idea in a completely different way. I'm going to come at this from the realm of sports because I grew up in the home of a coach. My dad was an American football coach of high school athletes my entire childhood growing up. And there's this thing in many, many team sports called watching film. And what that means is you have a game plan that you practice and prepare for, and then you go into that competition, and somebody films the game, and whether you win or lose, you have a time where the players get together with the coaches after the fact, and they watch the tape of that game. They watch the recording of that game, and they talk about what worked and what didn't. In these scenarios, when they're done well by a coach who is a good coach, the point of this exercise is not to make you feel bad or feel like a terrible person. It is literally to watch the recording of what happened and say, we had a plan. How did the plan work out in the real scenario? Did it pay out or did it not work? And why? I say that to say this. When my oldest child graduated from high school and went off to college, we had a conversation where I said, look, you're not going to be living in our home anymore. You're going to have your own place with your own friends, and all of your time is in your hands. And you get to choose how you're going to live that out, whatever you want to do. The biggest encouragement that I want to give you, it's kind of my last big shot at parenting, because you're an adult now and you're moving out, is, and this is not going to be a religious thing or anything like that. What I want to encourage you to do is, whatever you decide to do, when that thing is over, I want you to have the courage to be honest about how that went. You had a plan, you had a goal. You had a goal for this weekend. We're going to go and do this with these people, and I hope it goes really great. At the end of that thing, take an honest look at how that went. What was the proof of concept? The things that you decided to do, the actions that you carried out, the people that you hung out with, did it pan out? Was it what you expected? Or was it less than what you expected? Was it cooler than you thought it would be? Or was it way worse than you thought it would be? If we can have the courage to be honest about those things, then we can take a look at what do my decisions lead to? Not only that, what do my attitudes lead to? What do my words lead to? The way that I handle myself in relationships, how are those relationships panning out? If I go back and watch the film of the week that I just lived, or the day that I just lived, or the conversation that I just lived, then how did things pan out? I agree with you that it is really unhelpful to come at somebody with the idea of, you did this thing and it was bad and wrong, and therefore you are bad and wrong, and you should feel bad about yourself. That's a very ineffective way to talk to somebody about, you know, anything. Like, that would be a very unhelpful way to, for instance, supervise employees. If you were going to supervise somebody who worked for you at a job, it would be very unproductive to say, I didn't like the way that you worked last week, and because of the way that you worked, I think that you should feel really bad about who you are. The conversation from a good supervisor would be, what was the goal? How can we adjust that goal? Or how can we make some refinements on the strategy or the way that you're working? And how can I help support you? So let's dive back into the religious thing for just a second. I believe that God wants a relationship with you and with your friends. But I also believe that that God has gone to extreme lengths to get the sin issue taken care of on your behalf so that you have a chance to figure out what it means to live a life in a relationship with him. And I think that he wants to have the kind of conversation with you where, without shame or without guilt, the two of you can have an honest conversation about what are the things that I'm into and interested in and doing? How do I conduct myself in relationships, et cetera? And is it working? Is it giving me the fullness in life that I'm looking for? Or could I make some adjustments that would actually give me a more full, more satisfying life, more fun and sweet relationships, and just more contentment in my general experience of living in this world? I believe that God wants that for you. I do believe that God has gone to extreme lengths to take care of the really sticky parts of whatever sin is, however theologians want to describe it. And I think he would rather have honest discussions that would lead to you having a full life.
A wonderful, wonderful place to start that off. And Jed, where do we close this one out?
It's a great question. I love it. I want to suggest three things to think about. They very strongly overlap with everything that Lee just said. It's just really a different way of voicing the same chords. So the first is, you are allowed in your life to take a break from things. You're allowed to look at people and institutions and ideas and settings and be like, I'm done with that for a while. Maybe I'll come back to it, but I need a break. I'm not going to be on that for a while. I'm not going to be doing that for a while. People do that all the time with social media. You see people saying, I'm taking a break from social media. People do that with the news, which is often a very, very healthy thing. You're also allowed to do that with stuff within theology. And I'll give you an example that's not sin, but there's kind of some overlaps here. I think most cosmologists at this point believe, like, leaving aside anything spiritual, that the universe will end most likely in what's referred to as the heat death of the universe, but where all life everywhere in the universe will cease. So from like a physics standpoint, there definitely will be an end of the world someday. And the Bible does talk about the end of the world, but that was used to scare me the entire time I was growing up as a kid. So I just don't like thinking about it. So I'm not gonna. It has basically nothing to do with my life today. So I'm taking an extended break from it. At some point, will I come back to thinking about it? Maybe, but it's not today. And again, it has basically no relevance to my actual day-to-day life. So I'm not gonna worry about it. So, you know, John Hagee can write his 156th book about the end of the world, but not only am I not reading it, I'm not aware of its existence, which is just right by me. Me ignoring him is the greatest gift that I can give to the world. So similarly, you are allowed to take a break from things. You're allowed to be like, look, man, sin has been used. The concept of sin has been used as a cudgel to hurt me for a long time. And I'm hitting pause on that. That's totally permitted. That's totally fine. Here's the next thing that I want to tell you as a person who has worked for a lot of years in direct ministry. Solemnity and religiosity hardly ever helps anyone or anything. Labeling something as a sin rarely accomplishes anything other than to alienate the people involved. When people are doing something that's probably a bad idea, they often suspect that it's probably a bad idea. Also, and I can't emphasize this enough, there's reasons why they're doing it anyway. Many of which are probably very relatable and very understandable if you would bother to take the time to listen to them and get a sense of their story and what they're going through. Just as, you know, religiosity rarely helps, most people are actually making about the best decisions that they know how to make most of the time. It turns out that the best decisions that most people know how to make most of the time are often pretty poor, but they're giving it the college try, man. So, like, I mean, let's just think about this for a second. So I played t-ball for 1 year when I was 8, and I was not good at it. It's hard for me to put into words how bad I was at a thing that shouldn't be challenging to begin with. It's literally on a tee. Like, you don't have to track the ball. You don't have to think about it. it's there and you take a stick and you hit it. It's pretty straightforward. And I was so aggressively bad at it. Like the kind of bad where it's hard to miss. Now, I want you to imagine for a second if someone, particularly like in robes and with like a stole, and maybe they have like, you know, a thing of incense that they're swinging around. If as I'm sitting there knowing that all of the other 8-year-olds are much better at this than I am, if you come to me and be like, my son, not only is that true, and not only are you terrible at t-ball, it's because of sin. Like, how would that help anything? Thank you for that. I already thought that I sucked. Thank you for piling on. That really helps a lot.
Thank you, T-Ball Monk. That was very helpful.
All right. Man, I'm ready for the Netflix series T-Ball Monk. Like, that's kind of amazing.
Okay. Does he wear the ball cap over that bald spot that they intentionally... Yep. Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
The cap also has a flesh-colored part on the top. So it's a tonsure as well.
The cap is a tonsure.
Okay, so in my mind, he's rocking chaw the whole time. Like, he's speaking in those really, like, overly inflected tones, but he's got to stop every 5 words just to spit. Like, this is... Man, I'm ready for this. Yeah. Okay, so that all leads to the last thing that... and again, this is all, like... direct overlap with what Lee's already told you. I have been in therapy for the last couple of years. It's been super helpful. A lot of my friends and loved ones have been in therapy. It's super helpful. I can't speak for everybody, but I think that this is pretty true for most people who have been in or are in therapy, is the following narrative. There is a life that I want to have, and I am in my own way on trying to figure out how to get to that life. Mm. I need help fixing that. Let me repeat that back. Again, this wouldn't be true for every person every time, but I think it's commonly true for a lot of people as a narrative, and certainly true for me as a narrative for maybe I want to talk to somebody. There's a life that I want, that I envision for myself. That life is not happening, and at least a big part of it not happening is me. To quote Swift, it's me. Hi, I'm the problem. It's me. And I'm not sure how to fix it.
Jonathan Swift was a great writer, and he said many, many wise things like that.
And lastly, I need help fixing it, because if I knew how to fix it, I already would have done it, and I wouldn't be here. That's why I'm doing this thing that generally I'd rather not be doing. That narrative arc that I just described, which again is certainly true for the majority of people that I think are engaged in therapy, there's very little daylight between that and the traditional Christian narrative. That overlaps point for point with the idea of I need rescue and I need salvation. We're using different words. It also overlaps almost point for point with most 12-step programs. I am so sorry that religious people were a jerk to you, and that they were a jerk to your friends and to your loved ones. And as far as I'm concerned, you don't have to use the word sin ever again if you don't want to. It's no skin off my back. I don't care. I don't think you have to. But here's the one thing that I want to urge you to think about. I can't imagine I want you to imagine that when you were young, every time someone served you pizza, they came by and they punched you in the face, and you developed this terrible association that pizza and getting punched in the face are basically the same thing. I'd hate for you to go through the rest of your life never having pizza, because, man, that's a terrible way to live. Pizza's great. I strongly recommend it, and I celebrate all the variants. I'm not a purist. If it's called pizza, if that's in the name, like, pizza bagels are still they're still pizza, and I'm not open to debate about this. All pizza is good pizza. Similarly, being able to say, I'm having a hard time and I need help, is one of the most beautiful things in the world. And I would hate for you to not be able to have that in your life because of some jerk in a clerical collar. You deserve to be able to say, I'm having a hard time and I need help. Use the word sin if you want. You don't have to, but you deserve to be able to call out for help and receive it. Don't let someone steal that from you. Don't let someone steal that from your friends. It's one of the most beautiful things there is. You deserve to have help when you need it, and we all need help sometimes. Don't let anybody take that away from you.
That's absolutely right. A lot of fantastics out there, including a little tip for the listener. If you ever want to trick Jed into eating something, you just have to call it pizza, apparently.
Yeah, I'll eat it. That's cool.
And
he
will totally uncritically chomp down on that. Fantastic stuff from both of these guys. We're going to move on to our final question here. It comes in and says, the part of Matthew 4 where Jesus is tempted in the desert is weird to me. Why is there only one time that the devil tries to tempt him or even talk to him? It feels like this weird little side story that comes up once a year during Lent. Am I missing something? I think a really good question. And as we kick off the Lenten season here of our recording. Lee, where do we start off here?
Yeah, this is a very cool question. It's very interesting. And one of the things that's been happening for me lately is something I was totally surprised by. When I was growing up in church, like the church cultural context that I grew up in was, we understand everything about this book. We have no questions. And what's happened to me lately in the past 2 or 3 years is I'm realizing there's a lot about this book that like maybe nobody understands. And being okay with that and kind of allowing for a little more humility in terms of what's going on with this book. You know, maybe some of the chronology is weird and maybe some of these things don't exactly square. And I don't have to be afraid of that. I can just be a little more comfortable with it because their idea of what literature was a completely different thing to what we imagine it means to write something down or keep a record or whatever. So let's just start with that like the way that I think about telling a story is completely different than the way that these people thought about relating a story in their day. I say that to you to say this. I would have, my whole time growing up, I would have looked at that story and been like, oh my goodness, Jesus had a moment with Satan and then they never squared off again the whole time. That was just this bizarre moment. And then we don't get a ton of explanation for why it happened. We don't get a ton of detail about what the conversation was like. It's like a little vignette and then it's over. The thing that I would say to you now is, the people that put together the accounts of the Gospels, many of these folks, eyewitnesses, they highly designed these books. They highly designed them for different purposes that they wanted to get across. The reason that that's important is, and this is a little bit nerdy, but go with me if you will. The entire Bible opens up almost immediately with a story of, you know, a representative, a person who's representing all of humanity, who has a conversation with someone who wants to deceive them, and it involves food, and it's like a test, and they fail the test. And after failing the test, things go very poorly, down and down and down. And then that deceiver who put these human representative human beings to the test kind of keeps weaving his way into the story, slithering through, talking through other people, some of the same language, some of the exact same words and stuff like that, just kind of weaving through the whole story. And then all of a sudden with the story of Jesus, right here at the beginning of it, the people who organized this account for us organized it and stylized it to tell us a certain something about Jesus, which is all of a sudden we have a representative for all of humanity who is given a test with a deceptive character involving food once again. And where the original representatives failed, he triumphs. He comes out on top. He is able to pass the test. He is victorious in the trial. That's a very interesting thing. They are saying something to us about Jesus. He's like, where everybody else has screwed up, Jesus has passed the test. And he's actually, and this author wants to say this to all of us. He has come here to be our representative. He's come here to do something for us we couldn't do for ourselves. And it started right here with passing the test that not only did our original representatives fail, but all of us in our own ways have failed. And so what I'm trying to say to you is, I don't know how many times Jesus locked horns with the enemy that is called Satan in the Bible, which, by the way, Satan, it's a title. It means the accuser. I don't know how much Jesus locked horns with the accuser. I don't know if they had other times that they, you know, got into it or whatever. You can definitely kind of squint and see that he's showing up, influencing people and working through people and trying to mess stuff up for Jesus plenty. But I see that story as, hey, right as this story of Jesus kicks off, I want you to know someone has come to represent you who was able to pass the test that no one else has been able to pass. He's different than everybody else you'll ever meet in this whole story. And he's come here for you because he cares about you and he wants to stand in your place and do something for you that no one else can do.
Fantastically put. And Jed, where do we close this one out?
Great question. Very funky story. I definitely would recommend, we've mentioned this before on the podcast, the commentary series from a guy named William Barclay. His write-up on this story is really, really good. Strongly recommend reading it. You can Google it. It's free, and you can check that out. I think that there's actually an interesting takeaway. This is just my perspective, but for what it's worth, I think there's an interesting takeaway that's applicable to kind of all of our lives. So for me, I would like to group this story, if memory serves, right? So Jesus is baptized is the thing that happens right before this. And then he immediately goes out into the desert to be tempted. And so I would put those two things together as kind of two halves of the same story. And the reason that I say is there's this really interesting moment where when Jesus is baptized, the Spirit descends upon him like a dove, and the voice of the Father speaks, "This is my Son whom I love, listen to him." And it's this amazing moment where God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit are all, in essence, present on planet Earth in the material plane through sensory perception all at one time. You know, this is like a singularity in the history of the cosmos. It's this amazing, amazing thing. There can be, if you're in any way paying attention, and you're in this story, right, there can be no doubt that something amazing is going on, that Jesus is who he says he is, that, you know, this is the one sent to save God's people. And then he immediately goes out to be put to the test. Now, the reason that I think that's interesting is I think for a lot of us, there are temptations or tests or questions that the devil puts on Jesus that most of us face in our own lives too. Whether they come from the devil or not kind of doesn't matter. They are questions that we often ask ourselves, and recognizing that they are an opportunity for clarity in our lives is very important. So Jesus has been announced. He's been baptized. It's been made clear to everybody, you're legit. But he now kind of has to decide for himself of who he is and how it's going to go down and what he's going to do. So I think there's three points of clarity that the devil brings up that, again, I think are probably useful in each of our lives. The very first one is clarity of identity. Who are you? Because you'll note that the temptations from the devil begin with, if you are the Son of God, ... And I think that actually that kind of temptation, and sometimes it has to do with our spiritual identity, but in all kinds of things, man, being clear about who we are is such a strength. And not being clear about who we are opens us up to so many problems. If you've ever heard the phrase imposter syndrome, it's something that I think most of us have dealt with at one time or another, feeling like, I don't really belong here, and I'm not, so, you know, people are going to figure out I don't really belong here, and then it's, you know, they're going to, you know, ask me to leave and blah, 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 whether it's in a social situation or at a job or whatever. In that moment, at least on some level, we are struggling with clarity about our identity, clarity about who we are. And deciding on who we are is of critical importance, which is part of what you see Jesus doing, I think, in my reading. The second kind of clarity is, what is it that you are trying to do? Because part of what the devil is trying to get Jesus to do is to redirect off of his mission. Jesus has come to save people, and the devil is trying to redirect him into being, a carnival barker into being a stuntman, into being, you know, a political leader. Jesus isn't here for any of that. He's here to save people. And Jesus needs to be clear on what he's trying to accomplish in the same way that all of us need to be clear on what we're trying to accomplish. And that's true in the big picture sense of, you know, a life's calling, but it's also true in our relationships and in our work and in just our pursuits in life. It's very hard to accomplish anything if you don't know what it is that you're trying to accomplish. And we live in a world, and this is what marketers do, that is constantly trying to redefine our purpose, that is constantly trying to give us a sense of purpose other than the one that we showed up to this situation with. Clarity of purpose is super, super important. And the last one that, again, the devil definitely puts on Jesus that I think is useful for all of us is a clarity of approach. This thing that you're going to try and do, how is it that you're going to do it? The devil floats out for Jesus, again, in my reading, I'm not a theologian, but just in my layperson's reading, a bunch of stuff that makes sense of how Jesus could get his job done. He could totally wow people by, you know, magic tricks. He could just blow them away with how powerful and impressive he was. But Jesus understands that's actually not the way that he's been charged to do this. He's been charged to be a servant leader. He's been charged to, as Paul writes later, to make himself nothing. He has been charged to be the servant of all. And that clarity of approach, that clarity of how we're going to do these things, again, we live in a world that is constantly trying to redefine our identity, redefine our purpose, and redefine our approach. And the last thing that I would say is that being aware that no one gets out of having to struggle with clarity. If the Son of God has to wrestle with clarity, so do you. And no one has such a mountaintop spiritual experience that they no longer have to wrestle with clarity. Jesus was literally baptized physically with the Holy Spirit, and this is the next thing that happens. There's no such thing as being so spiritual or so amazing that you don't have to wrestle with clarity in your life. But if Jesus went first and went through it, we can do that too. On the other side of wrestling with clarity is actually doing the thing. For Jesus, doing the thing meant literally saving the world. But for each of us, we have a part in that too. Wrestling with clarity is part of how we get to the stuff we were made for, the good stuff, the exciting stuff, the adventurous stuff, the inspiring stuff. And to me, that is at least one of the takeaways from this story.
Really, really wonderfully said there by both of these guys. We're going to leave it there. If you have a question for us, say that podcast at gmail.com, thebridgechicago.tumblr.com/ask. You want to keep that entirely anonymous. Taylor, the song this week, this is Lee's version of the hymn, I Need Thee Every Hour. Take out that. Thanks for listening. Just remember, we love you. God loves you. There's nothing you can do about it.
I need.